And this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dorothy Gundy and Dan Novak. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Dorothy Gundy.
Management did not want to hear about her accusation of sexual assault, a former employee of Alibaba said. So she went into the lunchroom at the Chinese tech company's headquarters and shouted about her problem. Now she is facing online harassment and being called a liar by the wives of the two men she accused. She is also facing a lawsuit from an Alibaba vice president who was forced to resign. And recently, the company told her that she no longer had a job. Women in China often face such troubles if they choose to speak publicly about sexual assault. Women were especially targeted during China's short Me Too movement in 2018. In multiple public cases, victims were sued by the men who had been accused of harassment. Some have been targeted with online harassment and have been prevented from speaking about their cases. Former Chinese tennis star Peng Shuai disappeared from public after accusing a former high-level communist official of sexual assault. Her accusation was quickly removed from the internet, and discussion of it remains heavily censored. Monday, Peng posted a video saying that she was never assaulted. Women's rights activists in China fear that fewer victims will be willing to speak out. This is helping the wrongdoer and makes the workplace environment even worse, and it's an attack on the next woman who wants to stand out, said activist Zhao Shashuan. The former Alibaba employee told a Chinese newspaper that she would not advise other women to come forward. She said her own experience of being harassed online and called a liar has been very difficult. But she said to the Associated Press that she would continue her fight. She is being identified only by her last name, Zhao, because of harassment concerns. Zhao accused a fellow Alibaba employee, Mr. Wang, and a client, Mr. Zhang, of sexual assault during a work trip in July. She said she woke up in her hotel room to find Wang kissing and feeling her. She also said Zhang molested her while they were all at dinner. Police arrested both men in August on suspicion of forcible molestation, but released Wang after 15 days. Officials dropped the investigation into Wang, although Alibaba fired him. Zhang is still set to face a criminal trial. At first, Zhao thought she would get justice. Alibaba's CEO, Daniel Zhang, said in a public statement in August he would create an anti-sexual harassment policy. Senior leaders promised to improve management, she said. two executives, Zhao said, did not respond to her allegations, resigned. One has since sued her. So even though I was already covered in scars, I was still willing to trust the company and cooperate with the company, she told the AP. But last month, Alibaba fired her, saying she hurt the company. The letter said she was fired for spreading false information about her assault and about the company's handling of the issue. Alibaba has not answered requests for comments about Zhao's situation. Other victims have faced similar problems. Researchers at Yale Law School recently released a report about sexual harassment cases in China. The researchers found just 83 cases in public Chinese court records related to sexual harassment or molestation between 2018 and 2020. Of those, 77 were brought by the alleged harasser against companies or the victims. Victims sued their harassers in only 6 cases. Victims face a higher burden of proof in the courts, even when they are being sued. Experts say the national law against sexual harassment does not define any punishments. Enforcement depends on laws at the local level. Also, many companies do not have sexual harassment policies with clear ways for victims to seek justice. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Countries around the world are considering new limits on movement because of the fast-spreading Omicron version of the coronavirus. The proposed restrictions come as many people worldwide prepare to celebrate Christmas later this week. Omicron infections are increasing quickly across Europe, the United States, and Asia. Germany, Ireland, the Netherlands, and South Korea are among countries to have restarted partial or full lockdowns or other social distancing measures in recent days. In New Zealand, COVID-19 Response Minister Chris Hipkins said his country was delaying the start of a methodical reopening of its border until the end of February. All of the evidence so far points to Omicron being the most transmissible COVID-19 variant yet, he said. Germany's Robert Koch Institute for Infectious Diseases on Tuesday recommended that maximum contact restrictions be put in place. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said on Monday he was considering all kinds of measures. Sweden will urge all employees to work from home if possible and put in place stronger rules for social distancing. We must now take joint responsibility and we need to adapt to the new reality, Prime Minister Magdalena Andersson said at a news conference. In Denmark, Omicron is now the main version of the coronavirus. Health Minister Magnus Heunicke said. Many countries in the West are hoping that booster vaccine shots will help control the spread of Omicron, as some studies have shown 2 shots may not be enough. The European Union's drug regulator is prepared for the possibility that vaccines may have to be changed to fight Omicron. There is no evidence that that will be necessary yet. In Australia, Omicron cases have risen, but hospitalizations remain low. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison urged state and territory leaders to avoid more lockdowns. "We are not going back to lockdowns. We are going forward to live with this virus with common sense and responsibility," Morrison said. In the United States, the administration of President Joe Biden said it plans to buy 500 million COVID-19 tests that Americans can get online and use at home. Omicron was first found last month in southern Africa and Hong Kong. The form of the virus has been reported in at least 89 countries. The severity of illness it causes remains unclear. But the World Health Organization warned it is spreading faster than the Delta version and is causing infections in people already vaccinated or who have recovered from COVID-19.
A big city might not seem like the best place to learn about nature and the environment. But one group in Washington, D.C. is trying to change that. City Blossoms is a nonprofit organization with the goal of bringing nature to children who might not otherwise have green spaces. The organization has assisted in creating green space at 7 elementary schools, 2 high schools, and 18 early childhood centers across D.C. City Blossoms has its own educators who teach children lessons centered on gardening and nature. Tara McNerney is the director of City Blossoms and a former teacher. She said City Blossoms lessons center on environmental science, healthy living skills like cooking, and artistic expression. In the garden, students can learn environmental ideas like plant life cycles or ecosystems. But teachers can also use the green space for reading lessons by reading a garden-related book or learning nature vocabulary. Even math could be taught in the garden. "We are really able to adapt into the subjects that the teachers are wanting to teach," McNerney said. City Blossoms partnerships with local schools are meant to last at least 3 to 4 years. City Blossoms assists schools in creating and caring for the garden. But the gardens are mainly operated by the schools. McNerney said she partners with schools that already understand the importance of an outdoor education and that want to keep the garden at the school for many years. "It's a school-run program that City Blossoms is supporting," McNerney said. "We don't want it to be a plop-and-drop garden where it's seen as a City Blossoms garden, and it's not fully embraced by the community, because that won't really lead to a sustainable garden program." In City Blossoms' 5 other community gardens, the organization supports the garden and provides nature activities for the community. But the spaces remain community-driven. "At the end of the day, we're not designing these sites," said Issa Zambrano. She helps maintain the community spaces for City Blossoms. "The community designs it. Every garden takes the shape of the community and the culture that exists there." Young children and older adults have gotten involved with the community green spaces, said Kendra Hazel. She oversees the community gardens for City Blossoms. "During cooking lessons, for example, people will tell about meals that are special to their culture." "The community gardens represent the diversity of D.C., Zambrano said. "It's like putting pieces together of so many different people and cultures and neighborhoods." Healthy food is hard to find in some parts of Washington, D.C., especially in poorer areas. About 15% of DC is a food desert. A food desert is an area where the nearest supermarket is more than 1.6 kilometers away. In the two poorest sections of Washington, D.C., Ward 7 and 8, there are just three supermarkets for 160,000 people. Seven of City Blossom's gardens are in those two wards. Part of the organization's mission is to grow in spaces that might not otherwise have green spaces and might not have fresh, healthy food, McNerney said. For older students at two D.C. high schools, students learn how to grow and harvest crops through City Blossom's Mighty Greens program. Students in the program also sell their vegetables and herbs at local farmers' markets. While City Blossom's main goal is to teach children, many older families and adults have also gotten involved. The organization holds gardening lessons for all ages. Hazel said the pandemic has made people want to spend more time outside, experiencing nature. People have really woken up to the fact that green spaces are really important in our communities, Hazel said. They have realized the good that comes from being outside and being disconnected from technology, and just being, she added, and getting your hands dirty. I'm Dan Novak.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Grover Cleveland was elected President of the United States in 1884. He was the first Democratic Party candidate to win a presidential election in almost 28 years. Grover Cleveland defeated James Blaine, a senator from the Republican Party. The election was very close. Many Republicans did not vote for their own candidate. They voted for Cleveland instead. They believed he was honest and that Blaine was not. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe tell us about the presidency of Grover Cleveland.
Cleveland began his administration by announcing that he would reduce waste in the government. He would make government more like business. He said he would support reforms to let ability, not politics, decide who would get government jobs. Democratic Party leaders were quick to protest. They explained to Cleveland that the party owed jobs to those who had worked for his victory. Cleveland had to compromise. He permitted about 80,000 government jobs to be taken from Republicans and given to Democrats. This left 12,000 jobs. These would be given to people who did the best on government examinations. Cleveland's decision angered Republican reformers who had voted for him. They accused him of surrendering to the leaders of the Democratic Party.
On other issues, however, Cleveland refused to compromise. He opposed government economic aid to any industrial group. He vetoed a bill giving aid to farmers whose crops had failed. And he vetoed another bill giving more money to men who had served as soldiers during America's Civil War of the 1860s. The president also showed his independence by investigating gifts of public land that the government had made to the railroad, wood, and cattle industries. He found that many of these land grants were made illegally. He got back much of the land. He opened it to settlers.
President Cleveland signed into law two bills he believed would improve government. One was the Electoral Count Act. It set new rules for counting the electoral votes of the states. It would prevent future disputes over presidential elections, like the one in 1876. The other bill changed the list of officials who could become president if the president and vice president died or were removed from office. First on the list, after the vice president, was the Secretary of State. Congress changed this law again in 1947, and there have been four amendments since then. Today, the Speaker of the House of Representatives would succeed the vice president as president. Then would come the president pro tempore of the Senate, and then the Secretary of State.
Grover Cleveland approved a bill giving the government control over the cost of railroad transportation. The bill was called the Interstate Commerce Act. It limited the amount of money railroads could demand from people who needed to travel or transport their goods. The law established the idea that the government could control industries when necessary for the public good. President Cleveland also was concerned about a growing number of labor disputes that took place in the United States in the late 1800s. He proposed that Congress create a labor committee to help settle the disputes.
Congress failed to act on this proposal, but its lack of action did not stop the rise of a labor organization that had been formed a few years earlier. The group soon would become the most important labor union in the United States. It was the American Federation of Labor, or AFL. Led by Samuel Gompers, the AFL was different from earlier labor groups. It did not try to put all workers into one union. Instead, it tied together a number of different unions and gave them general leadership.
The AFL was different in other ways. It did not oppose the economic system of capitalism. It said only that labor should get more of the earnings of capitalism. The AFL also opposed extremists who used labor protests to change the social system. What the AFL called for were things workers wanted immediately: higher wages, a shorter work day, better working conditions. One of its first demands was an 8-hour work day. This demand led to a number of strikes and protests throughout the country.
The most serious incident took place in Chicago's Haymarket Square. More than 1,000 union supporters went to a meeting there, organized by an extremist. They stood calmly and listened to speeches. Just before the meeting ended, someone threw a bomb into a group of policemen. The bomb exploded with a blinding flash. 7 policemen were killed. The other policemen began shooting at the crowd. Some people in the crowd fired back. When it was all over, 10 persons had been shot to death, 50 others were hurt. The incident set off a wave of fear and anger across the country. The public demanded action against Union extremists. The Haymarket Square violence slowed the growth of organized labor in the United States for many years. It would be some time before labor became a powerful force in national events.
In the spring of 1886, President Cleveland announced that he was to be married. The ceremony took place in the White House. A few months later, President Cleveland and the First Lady went to New York City for the official ceremony welcoming the Statue of Liberty. The statue was a gift to the people of the United States from the people of France. It represented the alliance between their two countries during America's war for independence from Britain. The statue was the creation of French artist Frédéric Auguste Bartholdi. He decided to make a statue that would represent freedom, a statue of liberty. He said it should stand on an island in New York Harbor. There, he said, it would welcome all who came to America through that gateway.
Bartholdi decided to make a copper statue in the image of a woman, Lady Liberty. High above her head, she would hold a torch of freedom to light the world. The statue's face was the face of Bartholdi's mother. The artist asked French engineer Gustave Eiffel to build a steel support to hold the heavy statue. Eiffel was the man who later built the Eiffel Tower in Paris. The statue was built in France. Then the pieces were sent across the Atlantic Ocean. It was rebuilt in New York.
Grover Cleveland and his wife were not the only Americans to attend the Statue of Liberty ceremonies in 1886. Thousands of people crowded onto ships in the harbor to watch the great event. Thousands of others crowded the shorelines around the harbor. Everyone cheered wildly when a signal was given and a huge cloth fell from the statue. Lady Liberty stood holding her torch high for freedom. Under her feet were the broken chains of tyranny. Below the statue was a poem. It called to the poor and oppressed people of the world. It told them to come to America to find a land of hope and freedom.
Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shores. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed, to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door.
The Statue of Liberty was a great success. It was one of the great engineering wonders of its time, and it filled Americans with pride in their tradition of freedom and openness to people from all lands.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.